sorry to cause a distraction in the final moments of Arya's talk, but I just wanted, since my Turkish pronunciation is atrocious, so I just wanted to get these names up there, which I'll be referring to. Khan, maybe you can help out at some point. I really massacre them. I passed out to most of the people here this outline. This is a talk I gave here a couple weeks ago on a sort of overview of the ideology of anti-imperialism, and anybody who didn't get one, please share with somebody you're sitting next to, and you can write to me at that email address, and I'll be happy to send you the an attachment with this outline. So today I want to talk about two relatively little-known episodes in the development of anti-imperialist ideology. First, a left-wing variant in Turkey emerging out of the Ottoman Empire right after World War I, and then the case of Bolivia, where a fascist-influenced intelligentsia and military stratum of the 1930s evolved into the MNR that led, was very central to the better-known 1953 revolution in Bolivia. So what I have here, even when I gave this talk with an hour, I really covered about half of the points here. But the basic outline is the story of a strand of anti-imperialism going back, you know, anti-imperialism avant la lettre, before the term existed. And that was to German romantic populism as it developed starting in the late 18th century. In response to the universalism of the French Enlightenment and of the French Revolution. And I cite some works here. I note the work of Georg Lukács, The Destruction of Reason, and recommending only the first part. It was already a Stalinist diatribe, but when he's talking about German idealism and German romanticism or the circa 1800, he's not too bad. And the most important point he makes, and central to what I'm going to talk about, is what he calls the autonomization of the aesthetic in the form of the state civil service. And I can't overemphasize how important that is for both of the cases that I want to talk about. In the case of, first of Turkey, you have this guy, Ziya Gökalp, who was an intellectual. People tend to forget that a lot of the Turkic peoples at that time and still today were scattered through the southern periphery of Russia, now in many independent countries. And Gökalp originally came from one part of Russia, but quickly integrated himself into the Young Turk intelligentsia that seized power. Young Turk intellectuals and military people who seized power in 1908, the famous Young Turk Revolution. And he was a folklorist, among other things. And then in the case of Bolivia, there's a guy named Franz Tamayo, who spent many years in Germany before World War I, became totally enamored with German romantic populism, and particularly with the work of Fichte, the philosopher, whose famous speeches to the German nation were a kind of nationalist call to defend the singularity of German culture against the sort of pale, narrow, classical universalism of the French Enlightenment and the French Revolution. So out of this seemingly cultural, what is the relationship between people who start out with fascination with folklore as an expression of the genius of a people and the mercantile development state, which is what came out of the reflections of Fichte and passed into these anti-imperialist revolutions. It's essentially that we want to demarcate, for the purposes of development, a separate state, and this in these and many other cases meant state bureaucracy. Those of you who are familiar with Hegel know about his glorification of the Prussian monarchy and the Prussian civil service as the embodiment of the world spirit. These German romantics, and Fichte in particular, had a variant on that. And I so one, I think, without too much violence to history, can draw a line from Fichte's notions of the autonomization of the aesthetic, the revolt against Kantian philosophy, which we don't have time to talk about, and his idea of what he called the closed mercantile state, geschlossene Handelsstaat in German, which we find in the 1920s and 1930s, culminating in German Nazism, a literal closed mercantile state headed by a failed artist named Adolf Hitler, who devoted a tremendous amount of his time and power to art, aesthetics, and saw culture as central to Nazism. You know, those who see us as merely a political movement understand nothing about National Socialism, as he told the British ambassador just before the outbreak of World War II. Okay, now I have a whole outline here of how this develops. I just want to touch briefly on this, on figures like Alexander Hamilton and Henry Carey, who really first, in their own independent development, used these ideas to talk about a protectionist state, top-down development of early American capitalism against the free market ideology of Ricardo and British British world domination at that time. And very curiously, this was taken over by first Germany and then ultimately culminated in the Asian development state before and after World War II, so that American free market ideologues attacking the protectionism and closed quality of some of the Asian development regimes don't realize that American capitalism itself got off the ground with this kind of strategy. You know, you can get a PhD in economics in the United States and never hear about Hamilton's measures or Henry Carey, not to mention Friedrich List, the guy who sort of took this back to Germany and where it fused with these earlier forms of romantic populist nationalism. Okay, now, given the very short time I have, let me jump into the two case studies that I want to present. First, let's take the left-wing one, Turkey. Now, as you know, going into World War I, Turkey did not exist as a country. It emerged out of a national liberation struggle after World War I. And this, as the Ottoman Empire was dissolving, the great powers, the victorious allies in the war, had their plans for what became modern Turkey. The territory that is now Turkey was supposed to be divided up by four or five Western imperialist powers. Britain would get a part, Italy would get a part, France would get a part, and there would be this little rump Turkish state somewhere in the middle. And nevertheless, nationalist forces in Turkey organized resistance to this and built a national, probably the first national liberation struggle against a Western-backed invasion of the territory by Greece, but backed by France and England. And this led to a three-year war, which was ultimately won by the Turkish nationalists under Ataturk, Kemal Pasha. And the episode that really caught my attention in this whole process was when the Central Committee of the Turkish Communist Party, newly founded in the Soviet Union in late 1920, returned to Turkey to participate in the struggles that were going on. They were murdered off of the coast of Turkey in the Black Sea. This was in January 1921. And it's very curious that because the Soviet Union was cultivating ties to Ataturk and his nationalist movement, that nothing about this massacre appeared in the Soviet press for two or three months after the event. In March 1921, at the time of Kronstadt, the Anglo-Russian trade agreement, and a series of other signs that the revolution was sort of losing its internationalist momentum. The Soviet Union also signed a commercial agreement with the nationalist regime in Turkey, which was close to taking full power and driving out the Greeks. And let me just read this absolutely priceless quote from Leon Trotsky, secret memo to the Central Committee in the summer of 1920. This text of Trotsky, this is a very short memo, doesn't generally appear in the Pathfinder Press and other complete works of Trotsky. Listen to this. All information on the situation in Kiva, in Persia, in Bukhara, and in Afghanistan confirm the fact that a Soviet revolution in these countries is going to cause us major difficulties at the present time. Until the situation in the West is stabilized and until our industries and transport systems have improved, a Soviet expansion in the East could prove to be no less dangerous than a war in the West. A potential Soviet revolution in the East is today to our advantage principally as an important element in diplomatic relations with England. From this I conclude that, one, in the East we should devote ourselves to political and educational work, and at the same time advise all possible caution in actions calculated to require our military support or whatever which might require it. Two, we have to continue by all possible channels at our disposal to arrive at an understanding with England about the East. This is a kind of prototype of a kind of socialism in one country, foreign policy, a step back from the internationalism of the very early Russian Revolution that we more frequently associate with Stalinism. I wrote an article going into this in great detail that appeared in the journal Critique, which is also on the Break Their Hearty Power website for those of you who wish to pursue it. Now, getting back to the developments in Turkey. After the collapse of the Ottoman Empire, most of the military leaders who had been responsible for the military debacle, as you know, the Ottoman Empire sided with Austria, Hungary, and Germany in the war, fled to Germany. And one in particular had a very illustrious career ahead of him, a guy named Enver Pasha. He was another general, along with Kemal Pasha Atatürk, who had been directly associated with a series of Ottoman defeats. He went to Berlin in 1919, and who did he meet there? He met Karl Radek, who was there as a representative of the Communist Third International, who was in jail in Berlin, holding court in his cell, not just to the revolutionaries in Germany, but also to the German general staff, high-ranking business people such as Walter Rathenau, and basically setting the stage for what became this secret German-Soviet relationship from 1919 to 1922. When he met Enver Pasha, he decided this is our man, and Enver Pasha went on to Moscow and was equipped by the Soviet regime to start fighting against various Islamist forces in the Russian Civil War, the Civil War then in progress in the early Soviet Union. Enver Pasha got tired of being the cat's paw of the Soviets, and he changed sides, led a Basmachi revolt against the Soviets in 1922 and was killed. But it was very interesting that this guy, Enver Pasha, who had been responsible for the mass murder of the Armenians under the Ottoman regime, became a figure of the internationalism of the early revolution. At one congress, I guess it was the Baku Congress of 1920, Grigory Zinoviev said, well, comrade Enver may have committed some errors in the past, but now he has seen the light and is making up for those grievous errors by siding with us. And what I'm suggesting is that there was a conservative undercurrent of Soviet foreign policy that is generally ignored by left oppositionists who see Trotsky's defeat by Stalin and socialism in one country as formulated by Stalin as the real turning point. I'm suggesting that even much earlier there were feelers and links to very dubious forces. much time do I have left?
5 minutes.
5 minutes. Okay. I'm halfway into Turkey, and I haven't even gotten to Bolivia. So let me just try to simulate your questions for the question-answer period and get to the case of Bolivia. As I said, in Bolivia, you have this similar phenomena. What is generally forgotten is that anti-imperialism before World War I was stimulated in part with the support of the German imperial government, of the Kaiser, who's going around supporting agitation and movements against British and French the British and French empires. And into this framework fits Bolivia, where German officers were training the Bolivian army prior to World War I, as they were training armies almost everywhere in Latin America and in East Asia, Japan, China, et cetera. Yeah, it was through these kinds of institutions, as well as German direct investment, that this romantic populist ideology got to these countries and sort of animated their nationalism. Now, in 1935, Bolivia found itself in a hugely destructive war, again, largely forgotten, called the Chaco War against Paraguay, fighting over a huge area of eastern Bolivia that was assumed to have a lot of oil. And this war went on for 3 years, and I believe 100,000 Bolivians were killed, 60,000 Paraguayans were killed. I don't want to go any more into detail out of it, but it was very curious. And of course, these German-trained officers were central to the Bolivian war effort. A lot of unemployed white Russians officers were commanding the Paraguayan forces. That's another interesting fillip. But just before the war, who was in Bolivia working with the Bolivian general staff but Ernst Röhm, the founder of Hitler's stormtroopers, who spent 2 years there as a military advisor and happened to become friends with one of the key founders of the MNR movement. Now, out of this, Paraguay defeated Bolivia, even though Bolivia had twice the population, twice the armed forces. And out of the ferment, it was very much like Vietnam War in the United States, the ferment in Bolivian society led to the formation of a group called RADEPA, Razón de Patria, a group of young officers committed to the renovation of the country, as well as a circle of intellectuals who founded a newspaper called La Calle, which was kind of a street broadsheet that printed a wide variety of political views, but one thing that they were very consistent about was kind of unbelievable anti-Semitism. Unbelievable in part because there were very few Jews in Italy, in Bolivia at that point, but it was sort of in the international environment after the triumph of Hitler. How much time? 3 minutes. 3 minutes, great. This group around this newspaper, La Calle, included a guy named Paz Estensoro, who was still around 50 years later to implement Jeffrey Sachs's shock therapy in Bolivia in 1985, and another cast of characters who all played a key role in forming the MNR ideology. And in particular, a guy named José Cuadros Quiroga, who was an open Nazi and who wrote the 1942 founding program of the MNR that included such important points as the full stop on Jewish immigration and other unproductive immigration to Bolivia. Bolivia's anti-Semitism was prompted in part because one of the three top tin miners, a guy named Hochschild, was Jewish, a Jewish immigrant who had sort of made good and was always held up as a symbol of Jewish, Freemason, internationalist ideas that were undermining true Bolivianism. The Nazis were deeply involved in trying to win Bolivia over to their side in the coming confrontation with the U.S., with the U.S. and Britain. and Let me just wrap this up in saying, and hopefully this will stimulate questions where we can get into more details. During the war, when the United States realized that Bolivia was the only country in the world that produced tin that was not under the control of either Japan or Germany, Bolivia became very important in American foreign policy, and they started a whole program of aid and advisors and so on that sort of began to win Bolivia and ultimately even the MNR intellectual core over to being nice bourgeois Democrats and joining the American side in the Cold War. And just the last thing I want to say is, you know, what does this all mean? They were pro-Axis up till roughly Stalingrad. After that, they evolved into bourgeois nationalists on the side of the United States. But the continuity was, above all, in the top-down corporatist structural changes that they introduced when they took power. And in particular, the nationalizations under their umbrella organization called the Comibol, which was like a huge sort of holding company, as well as their state-backed trade union, the COB, Confederación Obrera Boliviana, which became kind of also an umbrella organization of workers, the poor, much beyond any strictly trade union kind of form. I'm really sorry that time has kept me from providing more details about this, but hopefully in the discussion we can get into it more deeply. So that's my quick overview of the sort of world historical career of German romantic populism and its institutional expression in military reorganization and ultimately statist economic reorganization of various developing countries.